I'm Nish Weiseth.
I'm Amy Sullivan, and this is Impolite Company, a show where we talk about the tricky subjects polite people are supposed to avoid, especially religion and politics.
This week, we'll discuss a couple of different stories centered around the Catholic Church. First up is the American Church's unified push for a permanent solution for Dreamers and protesting the federal government's current treatment of undocumented immigrants. Then comes the news that Illinois Senator Dick Durbin's bishop in Springfield has announced he will bar the senator from receiving Holy Communion until he repents of his support for abortion rights.
We'll also take a look at a recent report by the Anti-Defamation League that paints a sobering and horrific picture. The number of reported anti-Semitic incidents in the United States surged 57% in 2017 alone. It's the largest jump in the number of attacks in a single year in nearly 40 years. We'll break down the numbers and discuss why this spike happened. I'll say up front, we have one guess. But first, we have an announcement. As of today, we are now offering you, our loyal listeners, the opportunity to support Impolite Company through our brand new Patreon page. What you may not know, dear listener, is that producing a weekly religion and politics podcast costs money. Not a ton, but it does have some overhead. So we're hoping to raise enough money to cover our costs.
That's right. And we considered a few different options: joining a broader podcast network with built-in ad revenue, finding independent advertisers, etc. But here's the thing. We like having the freedom to do, say, and produce whatever content we want, however we want to do it. We don't necessarily want to be beholden to advertisers and allow money to be the driver of our content. We would rather let that power and influence continue to remain with you.
So that's why we're launching the Patreon account. It allows listeners like you to invest in the show. You can contribute as little as $1 a month, or as much as you'd like if you're rolling in piles of cash. And if you're rolling in piles of cash, DM us, please.
We will take all your money.
There are thousands of you listeners, so even the smallest amount of support can go a long way in helping us continue to do this show and hopefully to expand the conversations even further. Maybe even do a few live shows here and there throughout the year.
There's no pressure at all to commit. We are happy to keep on keeping on. We will continue to do this and continue to provide you with the absolute best and most thorough religion and politics podcast ever, no matter what. But your support would go a long way. So follow the link in the episode notes in your podcast app of choice and see if you can become a monthly patron of the show. We would love to have your support. Okay, moving on after that housekeeping note. If you have been listening to the show, you'll know that I've deactivated my Twitter account and that Twitter has been free of me ever since. I'm sorry and you're welcome. To kick off our show every week, we usually do a segment called 3 Minutes of Nish, wherein I get to unapologetically rage about whatever it is I would have gotten out of my system if I was still unloading my thoughts 280 characters at a time. But this week, we're going to do something different. Amy is uncharacteristically angry about some recent unsettling news, so I asked her if she wanted the 3 minute slot, and she did. So now here is her debut. Amy, take us away.
So over the weekend, I learned that the Southern Baptists are trying to bully the DC Baptist Convention into kicking out my beloved DC church, Calvary Baptist. And why? Because we called a married lesbian couple to be senior co-pastors of the church almost exactly 1 year ago. For this, the SBC is threatening to pull all support, including financial support, which would end the DC Convention's more than 100 years of dual affiliation with Southern Baptists and American Baptists. That's been an important symbolic partnership, an attempt to show that Baptists and the nation's capital can work together, despite some theological and ideological differences. After meeting earlier this month, the SBC's executive committee demanded that DC Baptists act by May to secure the removal of churches that, quote, have demonstrated a faith or practice of affirming, approving, or endorsing homosexual behavior, unquote. Well, first of all, this would be barely worth noticing because Southern Baptist gonna Southern Baptist, except that it looks like the DC convention is actually considering giving in to this extortion. And that's what galls me here. Calvary isn't just part of the D.C. Convention. It was one of six founding congregations back in 1877, and it's been intimately involved ever since. The convention overall consists of about 150 congregations, only seven of which are affiliated with Southern Baptists. Calvary actually used to be part of the SBC itself, but we stopped sending money back in the 80s, and we officially severed ties in 2012, only when somebody in the church actually realized we were still part of it, and we were all like, what? Second, this is not about Calvary being affirming. Not at all. The church made that stand official back in 2008, 10 years ago. And there are a number of other affirming congregations that are part of the D.C. Convention. That's the whole point of the convention, after all, that people of good faith can coexist peacefully. Neither the D.C. Convention nor the SBC just discovered that Calvary is affirming to LGBTQ Christians. For heaven's sakes, MSNBC aired a feature a few years ago on Calvary's decision to ordain a trans pastor, the first and still only time that's been done by a Baptist church. Nor is this about Calvary hiring a gay pastor. For the past 3 years, one of our resident pastors was an out lesbian and nobody said boo about it. Third, the whole point of being Baptist is that there's no hierarchical structure and nobody can tell you what to do. Now, sometimes Baptists gather in associations to do things they might not be able to on their own, whether it's lobbying or providing disaster relief or pooling resources to provide retirement or other benefits to their staff. But in its 131-year existence, the D.C. Baptist Convention has never, never disfellowshipped a church. This right now is simply about the fact that Calvary Baptist had the nerve to hire two outstanding pastors, two amazing and inspiring women of God who happened to be married to each other. Shame on the D.C. Baptist Convention if it declares that that is what for them constitutes a bridge to
wow. Look at you.
I'm mad.
You got mad. But I love how your mad is so responsible and measured. Whereas even your mad is always like very studious and measured. I'm the one that flies off the handle and just screams, I'm sorry. That was a good job. Well done.
I think I'm physically incapable of screaming.
That may
but
be true.
I love these people. I love this little church. I was part of the pastoral search committee. We moved to Chicago before they called Maria and Sally, but I love these people. And I'm so proud of the church they are and that we are. And this, it's just, it's wrong.
It is wrong.
Always to Sunday.
Wow. I'm sorry to hear the news. I'm sorry I got you mad, but good job. Okay. Let's move into our first topic. Catholics and dreamers. This past Sunday, Catholic bishops from across the country, from Cincinnati and Chicago to Washington and Austin, used their pulpits to deliver a sharp criticism of Congress's inaction to protect Dreamers, otherwise known as the millions of undocumented immigrants who arrived to the United States as children. And they called on their congregants to participate in a national call-in day on Monday to contact their congressional representatives and urge the protection of these Dreamers. We're recording this episode on Tuesday, and earlier today, a large group of nuns, priests, and Catholic lay people called Catholics for Dreamers protested in the U.S. Capitol and were arrested for their act of civil disobedience. It is worth noting to our listeners that the deadline for Dreamers and for the legislature in the House and Senate to pass any sort of legislation that would protect the Dreamers is March 5th. So it is very quickly approaching. And it's really, really important that the public put this pressure on our congressional representatives to make sure that they pass this legislation. The clock is ticking. And these Dreamers I like to call them undocumented Americans, really is what they are. They were raised here. They don't know any different. We have gone into much depth about the Dreamers and what all this entails. But I have to say, hearing that the Catholics like stood in the Capitol and got arrested, I was like, wow, well done. It's always really inspiring to watch a bunch of nuns get like carted out in handcuffs. You know, I'm like, what a bunch of badass women. That's amazing.
It is. Although, you know, as admirable as the nuns are, I kind of want to point out for our listeners who either are not Catholic or don't follow the church closely, what is kind of unusual about this activism, because the nuns actually are not really strangers to being arrested.
No. I mean, it's fun every time. Let me say that.
Definitely there is a long and active history of liberal Catholics and most recently a lot of nuns involved there engaging of acts of civil disobedience. Certainly when we were living in D.C. during the George W. Bush presidency, I have some good friends who are active in liberal Catholic circles, and it wasn't that they were getting arrested in front of the White House every other week, but it seemed like it sometimes. So they've been very, very active. And at the same time, the church has a long history of protecting immigrants. I mean, it is in its history an immigrant church. However, what is interesting here is the unified stance of the church. One, you've got not just Cardinal Supich and Archbishop Tobin in New Jersey, who are, you know, kind of the Francis guys in the U.S. You've got not just them being outspoken about this, but you've got guys like Cardinal Chaput in Philadelphia, who is nobody's idea of a liberal, who is standing shoulder to shoulder with them on this stuff. And what's more, to have the Bishops Conference call for a national call-in day and to have church bulletins, including information that's basically calling on every Catholic sitting in the pews to contact their representatives over this issue. I was asking on Twitter, because I honestly don't know, but I cannot remember the last time that the U.S. church did that for an issue that was not related to religious freedom or abortion.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe somebody can let me know about the history there, but it's been a long frickin' time since that has happened. And so to me, this does indicate some new step in terms of activism. I don't know if it's if it tells us something about the church and a new step for the church in today's political world, or if it tells us something about just how bad the administration is, that it has alienated Catholics and upset them like this. But whichever it is, this is kind of a new day, and it's worth paying attention to, because this does not happen all the time.
No, it doesn't. I was actually really pleased to hear that our bishop here in Salt Lake City has preached extensively about the need to protect the immigrant. And he wrote a really great op-ed in the Salt Lake Tribune last week titled "Dreamers Bring Diversity and Hope to Our Nation." And he himself is an immigrant to the United States. He's Filipino born. And so it's just, it's super inspiring to me to see this particular religious tradition come together, which does have a broad spectrum of belief. Now, I know that it's a little bit easier institutionally for a church or a community to come together around one issue when there is a consolidated or at least a hierarchical structure in the way that there is in the Catholic Church, as opposed to like the evangelical church or the evangelical expression of the church, which has no centralized authority whatsoever. But it is, it's still inspiring all the same to look at the overwhelmingly broad support of dreamers from all aspects of the Catholic Church. And of course, there are outliers, and there are very, very hardline conservative groups, whether they're Catholic or other different Christian denominations, that would say no to any sort of immigration reform, even protecting the dreamers. But it's still super, I don't know, I can't help but be inspired and to look at this and go, this is a huge step forward. And it's such a wonderful display of unity to say, no, like, this is who we are. This is what we stand for. And we absolutely reject anything that would go against these people and would force them into deportation. And so, I don't know, I'm just super inspired. I'm inspired to watch it and to watch so many lay people also get involved. I think there's kind of an initial, not initial, but it's a maybe easier camaraderie when you are a part of a leadership structure and you have colleagues and people that you're kind of naturally aligned with because of your position or whatever the case may be. But to see so many lay people also buy in and go, no, this is who we are. And for them to step up and participate in the National Call-In Day and to also participate in the protests that were happening at the Capitol. It wasn't all, you know, nuns and bishops and priests. It was a bunch of lay people too, who just said, no, this is completely antithetical to everything that we believe. And I find that truly inspiring, especially in this realm where it means you stand, you are literally kind of standing in the gap in between the people with power and significant power to actually do something, whether that's inaction on this legislation, which would then put Dreamers at risk, or to actually write the legislation and protect them, but that there's a group of people that were willing to stand in the gap between the people who have power and the people who are on the margins and who are the most vulnerable. It was so moving. Like, it's so moving to see that happen. And it makes me wistful a little bit for the evangelical church. And I'm like, oh, why can't we do that? Not to say that people aren't. There are plenty of people who are actually very enthusiastic about protecting the Dreamers. You know, you've got, I mean, tons of, I can't even go down the list of names, but yeah, I don't know, to watch people physically kind of put their bodies on the line and go, no, this is, we're going to protest. We're going to stand in the gap between, you know, ourselves and these people and like risk our own imprisonment over this it's a big deal. It's a huge statement. Regardless if the nuns have done it 1,000 times.
It is. And not to bring this back to crass kind of political factors, but we've discussed this before, and I do wonder whether, and if so, how much the decision to actually make this a broad effort by the U.S. Catholic Church is related to some of the anti-Catholic sentiments coming out of this administration. And here I'm thinking of last fall when Steve Bannon lashed out at leaders of the church, especially over their support for DACA recipients, saying, quote, illegal aliens are what they need to fill the churches. So that's why they support DACA. That did not go over well, say the least. And it's just stupid, unforced error. It's just cruel. But it's also, frankly, it's something Catholic leaders are not used to. They're not used to being referred to that way, especially from Republicans. And I wonder if that shook a few people up and they were like, yeah, well, we got to show you where we stand on this and how seriously we feel about it. This is not a matter of just, you know, we're afraid we're going to have to close some churches if we lose some folks to their home countries. It's, you know, these people are the church. They are our brothers and sisters in Christ.
That's right.
And, you know, may shake us out of our quiescence to actually do something about it.
Yeah. And I think actually the broad coalition of Catholics is just kind of a small snapshot. Truly of what the majority of the country feels about this issue. Like, the overwhelming majority of Americans want Congress to protect the Dreamers. Overwhelming, overwhelming majority. And to watch the Catholic Church, which historically it does, I mean, all these bishops, all these cardinals, like they don't always see eye to eye on things, to find such a united front on this issue, with the support of their lay people is indicative of how important this issue is to so many people around the country. I really do think that if Congress and the House and Senate do not come up with a solution by March 5th that is going to protect Dreamers, I truly believe they're going to pay for it. This is going to be one of the things that we will hear about relentlessly in the months leading up to the 2018 election, which should be, in a couple of hours now. I'm surprised we haven't heard actually too many like campaign ads already. It's already 2018, but I really do think so. I think that this is going to be a big factor in the election, particularly for Democrats. I mean, Democrats are going to go hard in on the DACA and Dreamer situation if this doesn't get passed. They will blame it on Donald Trump. They will blame it on the Republicans. And I mean, there's definitely some blame to go around. I think that the Democrats have been pretty stupid in some things regarding this issue, but...
But they don't control anything.
No, but they do... Republicans control all three houses of government, or all three areas of government. It's just like...
Yeah, you can't,
really,
both
you can't get anything done.
No,
you really can't. I mean, the Democrats probably could have done some things a little smarter, but overall, like, this... It rests at the feet of the people in power, and who have all the power, and that's the Republicans. So I think they're going to pay for it. I really do. I really think they're going to pay for it. But ultimately, I don't want anyone to pay for it because I want the Dreamers to be protected. That would be the ideal situation. So we'll see how it plays out. But it's love it.
Well, looking at... another priority for some other folks within the Catholic Church. Our second story is about the news that Springfield Bishop Thomas Pepperocki has said he will refuse communion to Senator Dick Durbin because of the senator's support of pro-choice policies. And that's, he would refuse it to him if Senator Durbin presents himself to receive communion. This is, unfortunately, an issue I know rather well, both from my time working for Tom Daschle in the Senate when he was dealing with kind of similar back and forths with his local bishop. But also, this happens to be one of the topics I decided to do some research and writing on in graduate school, because that's the kind of fun person I am. So, just as a little kind of backgrounder for people, the reason that this has been an issue for decades now, and really kind of bubbled up in... the modern era during the 1984 presidential race, because Geraldine Ferraro was a pro-choice Catholic running on the Democratic ticket. And so she kind of got targeted by some Catholic leaders in the U.S. But around that time, also Mario Cuomo, who was at the time the Democratic governor of New York, and who was also... mostly pro-choice, was very outspoken. He gave a famous speech in Notre Dame in 1984 explaining how it was possible for him to hold certain views privately as a Catholic, but not have them interfere with his public duties as a governor who represented people of all faiths and no faith. This was not an argument that leaders within the U.S. Catholic Church liked. And that was kind of the start of an era that's really continued up until now of by no means across the church. But every so often, you'll have somebody like Bishop Pepperocki who decides that they feel called to make an example of a pro-choice politician. It is almost always a Democratic politician they choose to make an example of. The one exception I can think of is Tom Ridge, when he was the pro-choice Republican governor of Pennsylvania. To my knowledge, if I'm remembering correctly, he was disinvited from a couple of events at Catholic institutions in Pennsylvania. I don't think he was ever threatened with the denial of communion. But just to throw that out there, that it's not that it's only been applied to Democrats, but I would say 99% of the time it's a Democratic politician. And this was even, you know, before the two parties were as kind of filtered on the issue of abortion as they are now. But the reason Catholic leaders give for singling out pro-choice Democratic Catholic politicians is one that does make some sense. They argue that those leaders, particularly if they identify themselves publicly as Catholics, are unusually visible examples of what it means to be a Catholic, and that there is a risk if they are outspoken about being Catholics and outspoken about being pro-choice, which is not the official position of the church. The official position of the church is to believe that life begins at conception, and so you therefore oppose all birth control and abortion, that those politicians then risk leading ordinary Catholics astray and leading both Catholics and non-Catholics to believe that the church's teaching is more muddled than it actually is. And, you know, I got to be honest, like that makes sense. And I understand it. I do believe that it has been, as I said, applied inconsistently. So it does make me question the motives when various leaders decide to go after, say, Joe Biden or Nancy Pelosi or John Kerry when they have not done the same for Republican pro-choice politicians, and certainly when they haven't done the same for Republican Catholics on a whole host of other issues where they disagree with the church. But I understand, don't send me angry emails, I understand that the church's teaching on abortion is a little different than on some of those issues. But what's so interesting to me here, and so we get to tie it into one of the other Catholic bits of news that we both kind of perked up to see here, is this idea of what the church calls scandal of leading Catholics astray. That's the word in quotes, scandal, is how it's traditionally been referred to within the church, is that that is something, it's not scandal as an embarrassment. It's a very dangerous and discouraged, almost sinful position to put the church in. And so it's a very, very big deal. Earlier this week, Pope Francis talked about scandal and talked about his concerns of what causes scandal. And, you know, this fits in with kind of what he's been talking about in the almost 5 years now. And you realize, Nish, we're going to have to do a like 5 years of Francis hullabalooza something to celebrate him becoming Pope. But what he's been talking about since he became Pope is the reputation of the church and those instances in which the church does good in terms of promoting Catholic witness, and often those instances in which it is hurting Catholic witness. And so what he said on at morning mass, and I love, as another tangent, the fact that he continues to deliver homilies at just like regular morning mass at the Vatican. He said earlier this week that that there are Catholics who exploit people, that there are people who lead double lives or manage dirty businesses, do something that hurt people. And he says, but to be a Catholic like that, it's better to be an atheist. That That is scandal. To be a Catholic who reflects poorly on the church by the way you conduct yourself, by the business decisions you choose to make, by choosing to be involved in exploitation, and that has been a key theme of his papacy, that is a scandal. That reflects badly on the church. And I'm not saying that he would argue a pro-choice position isn't a scandal, but he is definitely continuing to broaden the scope and say, oh, okay, you want to make this a big deal? Then you also have to be paying attention to all these other things, because that is a scandal. That is driving people away from the church. And if you're going to care about this, if you're going to be that kind of a Catholic who reflects that poorly on the church, then better you not be a Catholic at all.
Right.
This man is fire.
I love him for a lot of different reasons, but this is one of them. I mean, that's a pretty bold statement. Like, every time I kind of sit back and read what he actually said, I'm like, wow. He went there. But he just has this history of, like, going there and actually just saying the thing, which I really appreciate. One of the things that I wanted to ask you about, back when we were talking about Dick Durbin specifically, and how this is typically been used, you know, as a way to make an example out of specific leaders or people who are more high profile, and knowing that Democrats are overwhelmingly more pro-choice than they are pro-life. But the flip side of that is there are more, I'm looking at the layout right now, or the survey of religious affiliation for the members of Congress, for the 115th Congress, and there are 74 Democratic Catholics in the House, as opposed to the 70 Republican Catholics in the House. And then there are 15 Catholic senators who are Democrats versus the 9 who are Democratic Republican senators. And I just find it, I find that particularly interesting. I don't know why necessarily, but like as I was listening to you talk about it and about, you know, using a, you know, specific someone to make an example out of them, given the current dynamics of the religious makeup of the House and the Senate, but also the fact that it's the Republicans that have power in both houses of Congress, I just find it interesting that they would pick on the Democrats. Does that make sense? For something that they don't really have any power to change right now anyway. Because it's not like they're going to go expand abortion rights with the current layout of the Congress, both in the House and Senate, because the Republicans have control. So it's not like they're trying to advance a pro-choice agenda right now. And so to make an example out of Dick Durbin feels like the timing just feels weird. Does that make sense? And I don't know if it has nothing to do with it. It may have nothing to do with politics. It may just be this one guy and his deep conviction, or however that plays out. But the timing just feels weird, looking at the layout of how the affiliation goes in both houses of Congress with who's Catholic and who's not, but also who's in power. Does that make sense? Like, it just feels a little weird to make an example out of someone like Dick Durbin.
It is the specific example that I think led to this was the Senate voting, I think it was last month, it must have been January, on the so-called Pain-Capable Unborn Children's Act, which Durbin voted against. And I'm sure the bishop lobbied him on it. And Durbin voted another way.
Demurred.
And, you know, sometimes just in the ongoing back and forth between Catholic members of Congress and their direct kind of pastoral Catholic leaders, sometimes there's just a breaking point. For Daschle, it was the original partial birth abortion ban. And his decision to vote against it early on caused his bishop to warn him that you can't continue to call yourself Catholic publicly. if you do, we may have to kick you out of the church. And it never got quite that far, but that was the all but stated threat.
Hmm. Okay, so that makes a little more sense to know that there was a sort of, what's the way to phrase it, legislative impetus to what happened. That makes a little more sense to me than just kind of like out of the blue, rando bishop from Springfield is like, you know, Dick Durbin, you can't take communion. It's like, where did that come from?
Yeah, no, there's usually something. It's usually
a policy or some sort of statement.
A statement that they make. Like I'm thinking Nancy Pelosi was mouthing off a few years ago about...
As she does.
well, sometimes she goes just a little too far.
Yes.
And to be totally open here, like, I feel for these Catholic Democrats. I have interviewed enough of them about how heartbroken they are that this church that has meant so much to their lives, that has formed the faith that sustains them, that this church would not consider them good Catholics, tears them up. And I've watched senators and representatives start crying over the fact that this church means so much to them, and yet they are often disinvited. There's an interview I've written about a number of times just because it so struck me with Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro from Connecticut, who talked to me about how I believe she had sat on the board of the Catholic girls' school she had attended for high school. And she was told that she couldn't do it anymore, that the local archbishop wanted her kicked off.
Gosh.
And it was a gut punch to her.
Of course.
This place that had formed her. She wasn't considered worthy of serving. She had wanted to give back, but they didn't want her kind. Anyway, it's a complicated, complicated issue, and is one of the reasons I am glad I am not Catholic. because I do understand the internal logic. It is hard to disagree with that. And so I do feel for folks on all sides, but especially the Catholic Democrats, who they're just stuck because you cannot, there's not a lot you can argue. You know, they try arguing, well, this is my personal conscience tells me I have to do this. It doesn't fly like that in Catholic social teaching.
Mm-hmm.
There's no such thing as your conscience trumping the teaching of the church. So ultimately, you know, I almost became Catholic when I was a child because I'd go to Mass with my dad every so often, and they sold donuts after Mass, and those donuts were good. And I have a sweet tooth, and if I went often enough, I might have just become Catholic for the donuts. But fortunately, my mom is the one who calls more of the shots in our family, so she had us going to the Baptist church more often. And even though I don't think that my beloved Baptist potlucks could live up to a soft, fluffy donut, I was in with the Baptists.
Yeah. You know, I would become Catholic. I just love St. Ignatius, the Ignatian practices. I would be a Jesuit. That's what I would be. I would be a Jesuit.
You can't be a Jesuit without the rest of it, though, Nish.
I know. And the whole, like...
And no women.
You know, women.
That's what it comes down to.
The gays. I kind of have a problem with apostolic authority and also a closed table. So really, I can't be Catholic at all.
So apologies to all you Catholics out there.
Yes, but I really do. I love the practices of the Jesuits. It's just beautiful. Anyway, okay, let's move on. We have another topic to discuss, and unfortunately, it is really, really horrific. We want to talk about a report released this week from the Anti-Defamation League, and it stated that anti-Semitic attacks in the United States increased by 57% in 2017 alone. This is the largest jump in the number of attacks in a single year since the League started tracking attacks in 1979. And for the first time ever, incidents were reported in all 50 states, and the location where most incidents occurred, this just breaks my heart, was in K through 12 schools. And the number doubled in 1 year. And in a similar report released last month, the League found that white supremacist activity increased by 250% on college campuses in just 1 year. Amy, I have a hunch as to what something, like, what are the things that are driving these sorts of attacks?
Well, and we should also make clear from the start that when we're talking about these numbers, this is not like it went from two incidents to five. So it's an
increase. These are in the thousands.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's in the thousands. So, I mean, it's significant. You can look at the chart. And it just, I mean, 2017, just huge spike. It's really, really scary. And as I have experienced this year, my daughter this past year went to a Jewish preschool and there was a bomb threat at her Jewish preschool. And so walking through that, I mean, we are not Jewish. We are Christians, but to watch these sorts of attacks and these threats hit a community like head on, and to actually be kind of a peripheral part of that community felt, I mean, it was terrifying. It was absolutely terrifying. And looking at the landscape of our country, there are a lot of different drivers, I'm sure. A huge one is social media. You know, the rampant anti-Semitic activity that's happening on social media, obviously the big protests and white supremacist activity that we saw in Charlottesville. There are so many different incidents that we can look at and so many different items that could potentially be seen as causation. But for me, I can't help but look at the ways in which the president of the United States has, for all intents and purposes, emboldened some of these groups with his language from the time he first announced his candidacy for president, like far before he actually took office. Not to say, I mean, it has continued since he took office. I will reference back to the time that he said that there were good people on both sides of the Charlottesville protests, talking about white supremacists and neo-Nazis. What in the actual hell? But his language, the things that he says, the things that he incites, the imagery that he uses it has done nothing but embolden some of these groups and some of these people to carry out these attacks on the Jewish community. And it is just heartbreaking. Like, you would think that the president of the United States that would speak out forcefully against any sort of attack on a religious community or any community that was bigoted, that was racist, that was just hate-filled.
Oh, but on the contrary, Nish, when he is accused of either encouraging anti-Semitism or engaging in it himself, he is then the victim. Because don't you know, his daughter and his grandchildren are Jewish. So therefore, he can't possibly be guilty of any of this. To which we must call BS, to quote Emma Gonzalez on calling BS on all sorts of other things. I have so, so many thoughts about this. But the main one is, we know our world history and we cannot afford to let a spike like this continue or get worse. We know what happens. You know, you talk about how there are many contributing factors, and there are. Foremost among them, I would say, is just the normalizing of expressions of hate just in general. There is always a bubbling anti-Semitism below the surface, and it has just been welcomed out into the open in the last few years. But this is not a new hate, and this is why it's important to always be vigilant, because we know going back thousands of years where this can lead. And I don't just care about it now because I have a Jewish husband and children who identify as Jewish and Christian. This is something just it.
We should care about it regardless of who we're associated with, right? Like,
but it particularly drives me insane when we are thinking about all of the cries of religious persecution from the religious right. Because this is persecution. Like, this is discrimination based on religious identity and based on religious belief. And the idea that we need to pull out all the stops and make top priority protection against possible religious persecution down the line that could result, when it is right in our face, happening, and yet it's not to our in-group. So, you know, maybe if we have time, we'll pay attention to it. Just absolutely not acceptable. I was last night, because our little four-year-old knows that Purim is this week, and he wanted me to tell him the story. I was talking to him and telling him the story of Queen Esther, and it's, as you know, explaining a lot of things is so difficult to a small child, but particularly why would people hate the Jews? And just trying to explain that. And we try not to talk a ton about politics with the kids and try to impose our beliefs on them. But he drew this comparison himself. He was like, oh, so Haman is like President Trump.
Out of the mouth of babes.
Yeah. You know, he's not wrong.
I detect no lies.
Not wrong.
The evangelical right, or the conservative Christian right, however you want to phrase it, Trump's evangelical advisory board, all these people will get up in arms and waste no time coming out and talking about a gay couple who would like a wedding cake, but we hear silence about a kid who gets a swastika painted on his locker. And it is like, it is outrageous. It is outrageous. It should make all of us fiery mad. Regardless of your religious affiliation, regardless of your political affiliation, no matter where you live, no matter where you're from, no matter if you know someone is Jewish or not, like, obviously people who have people in their life who are Jewish or are Jewish themselves, this is going to hit a little closer to home. However, this is something that should enrage every single one of us, and we should not stand for it ever. And we should not stand for it for any religious community. That includes Muslims in this country as well. And because we see persecution of them too. And it, like, the what Trump has done and what this administration continues to do is give license. It gives license to people to continue to discriminate against people who look different than them. And not just discriminate, but actively harass, assault, defame their property, violate their rights. It is abhorrent. And the fact that there is silence from the people who talk so loudly all the freaking time about religious freedom makes me so mad. And it goes back to the point that I made many, many episodes ago, that this whole idea of, like, quote unquote religious freedom when it comes to like a gay couple wanting a wedding cake, for instance, that that's not about religious freedom. That's about just sticking it to the gay community. If you really did care about religious freedom, you would stand up for persecuted people the world over, and you would do so consistently, vocally, and with abandon. You would not hesitate for one single second to stand up for these communities loudly and affirm them and their humanity at every possible opportunity. And the fact that we are hearing silence across the board, Amy, makes me so freaking mad. It's so hypocritical. It's disgusting. And we should be calling out these leaders left and right until they say something and actually do something further to protect these people, and to actually do something and enact, maybe even enact legislation to do something to get this number to drop back down. Because a 250% increase of white supremacist activity on college campuses is unacceptable. A 57% increase of anti-Semitic attacks on United States soil is absolutely unacceptable. And the fact that the majority of these things occurred in grade school should be the most alarming part of this statistic, because kids will do what they see. They are mimicking the actions of the adults in their life. And that is really, really, really alarming, that not only are these kids learning this sort of rhetoric and this sort of behavior, but they're actually acting on it against their classmates. We have to stop this, and we have to stop it now. Like, I can't say it more emphatically enough. So I didn't get my 3 minutes earlier, but I feel like I got it now.
No, I think you more than got your rant in.
Sorry. Sorry, not sorry.
And we are out of time. So to wrap up the show, every week we like to leave you with a recommendation, a TV show, a movie, maybe some music. Nish, tell me you have something this week.
Oh, well, I don't know if it's actually out yet, but apparently there is a documentary coming soon to HBO called The Final Year. And it is about it's an insider's account to President Barack Obama's last year in office, specifically from the perspective of foreign policy. So it has in-depth interviews with John Kerry, Ben Rhodes, Samantha Power, and I think those are the big three, and Obama himself. And so I really, really want to see that. It's coming out on HBO. Or it is out on HBO. I'm going to look.
It's been out since January.
Has it been out since January on HBO? Oh, okay. Then I need to watch it. iTunes, Amazon. I think it's coming to HBO or is on HBO. You can get on Google Play, all the different channels. So I do want to watch that. That's my movie. And then I have been, I'm going to lose my, I don't know, maybe I'm going to lose some like outside the evangelical mainstream street cred here. But I've been listening to Bethel music, like their worship albums lately. And I don't know, maybe it's because I've been out of my church. We're coming up on a year, which is crazy, since we left our church last April, which is another story for another day. But left our church about a year ago. And so I think maybe I'm just feeling a little like sensitive and kind of missing it a little bit. I don't know if that makes sense. So anyway, we sang a couple songs from Bethel back when we were in church, and I've just been feeling a little sensitive toward it. So I've been listening to Bethel music, some of their worship albums, and it's been so, so good. Their most recent one, I'm trying to figure out, let me see if I can look and see what the name of it is. Anyway, but the one song that I love from it is called The King of My Heart. The chick who sings it is just unbelievable. But the most recent album that I love is called Starlight, and it was recorded while they were on tour. So anyway, that is what I am watching and listening to this week. What about you? Did you find anything?
Well, yeah, I actually have a similar recommendation. I have been listening to Audrey Assad's new
Audrey's new album is out,
yes,
too.
Evergreen. came out week. And I am enjoying that. However, I have to say what I enjoy most are her covers of just classic classic Baptist hymns, classic church songs. And
because she's Catholic now.
Is she?
Mm-hmm.
Well,
yeah.
Whatever she is, her music just calms my soul. And so it is definitely my like default
and her voice,
listening,
man.
These days. It just makes me so happy both to get the combination of her beautiful voice and musicality with the songs that I associate with being a young child in the church.
Mm-hmm.
And
so good.
I just love it so much. So Evergreen out this week, Andrea Saad. I recommend it.
So good. I need to listen to it more. I only gave it one listen through, but her voice, man. I could listen to her sing all the live long day. Okay, that is all for this week's episode. Thank you for joining us. Impolite Company is produced every week by Constantine Hios. If you've enjoyed our conversation, please, please, please rate us on iTunes. I cannot beg you enough. It is the very best way to let other people know about us. And if you would like to support the show, check out our Patreon page and consider supporting us financially so we can continue to expand these conversations even further. And as always, we will post the show notes on our website. Until next week, have fun storming the castle, kids!